Good afternoon. That's again a lovely, lovely silence. That, you know, is the meat of what we do. The principles that we know become our demonstration, because what we know of the principles are just words, but these words hold within them such action. When you think of oneness, that really is a word that you can put a definition to it, but when you experience it, it then has a whole nother connotation. The same with omnipotence, one power, omnipresence. When you have been feeling lost and suddenly that feeling comes to you, that sense of completeness, the sense of harmony, the fear goes away. You know that what that is. You identify it as omnipresence, but even that word brings your awareness into a deeper sense that, oh, this is God and I am not separated. Therefore, whatever it is that's coming to me as a problem is totally dissolved. And this is our activity in the world, living by principles, and it is the silence that defines really these principles. It moves it out of the intellect, of the mind, as Joel says, into the soul, and then we live from this soul center. And the activity, you'll find the activities of your life change with meditation. And continuing with the art example, it's practice, practice, practice. In the beginning, and I'm sure most of you have a routine where you meditate, but there's a, just a danger in a routine, but you can get stuck in a routine where meditation is almost like a habit. And if it becomes a habit, you're not paying attention. You go into meditation and you have a silence and maybe you have some inspiration, but maybe it's just the silence and you go on through your day. And if there is no activity in the silence, you can easily learn how to still your mind. And stilling your mind is just the very first step in meditation. That's basically that's preparing the canvas. If we use the visual artist, you've put the gesso on your canvas, you've got it all stretched, you have it all prepared. That's the still mind. Now, an artist might sit in front of that canvas and they have to do something. And where is that action going to be coming from? Maybe they're is a concept, there's an idea, but when you stare at that blank canvas, you're going, is that right? Where do I begin? Where do I make that first mark? How do I take that first step? Now, the impulse, the inspiration to take that first step is the activity of God, the activity of this creative principle. So, in our meditations, that stillness is then you sitting before the canvas of your day, of this now moment, and having the inspiration to say, where do I make that first mark? What do I do first? If I'm a business person and I have to go to work, I have a meeting, okay, I say, this is what I have given me today, how do I then make that activity coming from soul, coming from consciousness, and not just coming from this world. So you have prepared yourself just that challenge, you might say, of moving into the day. You are moving into it with this underpinning of spirit. If you're retired or you're not working, what is your activity in the day? Where are you giving? Because this way of life is the way of giving. Without giving, we shrivel up. We just dry up and are blown away, because God is always in action. There is no inactive aspect to God. And again, this is kind of paradoxical, because everything is complete, so what is God doing? Well, God is being, and just the beingness of God infuses our lives with purpose. And this purpose isn't about accomplishment. It's about being instruments of illumination, instruments of peace, instruments of creativity, being instruments of truth. The poet, was it Yeats or Keats? Ode to a Grecian Urn. Keats. The end of that, when all is said and done, beauty is truth and truth is beauty. Now that, you might, if you looked at that poem, you might say, well, here's this whole circle. You start out contemplating an urn, you describe it, you have all the wonderful things that it means to you, and you've gone around this whole circle, but when you come back to it, you come back to truth is beauty and beauty is truth. So when you are an agent or an activity of truth, you're also an agent of beauty. There's no ugliness in God. I mean, this creation is beauty itself. If you see ugliness or you see the negativity, that's coming from conditioning. That's coming into your consciousness through experience or this having been taught. I love that song from Oscars and Hammerstein, The South Pacific. You have to be carefully taught to hate and fear. You have to be carefully taught to accept the prejudices of this world. And the greatest part of our spiritual journey, once we have begun this living as creative as we can, living out from our spiritual center, is that we unlearn so much of what we've been taught. And so much of what we unlearn still today goes against the grain of what everybody is accepting as truth. But in the face of spiritual truth, error cannot exist. That's why Mrs. Eddy, back 100 years ago, would not term it evil, would not term it anything that you could grab a hold of. It was an error, a mistake. Jesus didn't term it evil. Jesus termed it an appearance. See through the appearances. You go to the Buddha. He discovered under the Bodhi tree that material good and material evil are one and the same. Came from the same God, Kali. She changed when she couldn't frighten Buddha into abandoning his meditation. She tried to entice him with all the good of this world to abandon his meditation, and that's when he gained enlightenment. He saw that human good and human evil are one and the same thing, and that spirit is neither good nor evil. It is true, but that truth, the grace of God, is good. There is no error in it. So to the intellect, good has an opposite. It's a duality. We have a friend who is a philosopher. He says, well, you can't have good without evil. I said, why not? He says, well, you have to have an evil to contrast the good. If you didn't have evil, you wouldn't have any good. I said, well, then that's a world of duality. But there's a world of oneness where you can have one God, one life, one presence, one good, and there's no opposite to it. And this is what we bring into our lives when we bring truth into our experience. We bring this spiritual reality into every situation. And the creative part is that we all have different loves. We all have different interests. We all have different work. And so it's going to be unique in our experience. Nobody can say how is going to happen. It's just that when you embrace the spirit and you see through these appearances, it constantly is new. It's constantly revealing something new to you if you're alert in a situation, within your own body, within your work. So I said this morning I would open the afternoon up to questions. So if there are questions, basically about principle, or applying principle. I mean, I think that's where we are. How do we apply the principles in our everyday life? And that is individual and unique, and sometimes our conditioning would might add a layer of confusion to the principles, to applying the principles. But omniscience is within. So if there are any questions, otherwise.
I do have a question, John. In my particular case, I'm like semi-retired, but I feel I should be doing some more business. But I don't seem to get a sense of direction on it, like what practically to do. I'm trying to listen inwardly to the stillness, and I can rest back in the stillness, but, which is nice and peaceful, but still don't seem to find the direction.
Well, I think there's an action then that takes place. You know, Joel said you can never make a mistake. And I think our dissatisfaction, you know, is that we're afraid to make a mistake. We're afraid, for whatever reason, money or whatever it would be, if I go and I try this and it doesn't work, then what am I going to do? But if you are grounded in that principle of omniscience, when you make a step, since the activity of the spiritual dimension is love, when you make a step and there's an opening, then you take another step and you keep moving in this direction. Sometimes they're very small steps. If it is not a right activity, that there will be something that will make it difficult. There will be something that basically tells you that this isn't the road to take. Or there could be, now I had an experience, again, when I was young. I was invited to sail the South Pacific, and it was just a dream for me to do. But as the trip got closer to fruition, there was a lot of trepidation on my part. Fear. Not so much fear of the being at sea, but fear of the owner of the boat that I was sailing with. And it came to me, I would do it anyway. And I remember my mother had just given a class in Hawaii, and Emma Goldsmith was there, and we all, the day before we set sail, had a meditation. And both my mother and Emma said, you know, you can back out of this. And there was something that within me that said, if you back out of this, you are going to miss an opportunity. And then my mother said, you know, this is going to be an initiation. And I thought, whoa. And so our directions, and initiations don't have come just to young people. I mean, you can have an initiation. What is an initiation? It's breaking through a barrier, a resistance. My resistance is that I avoided conflict at all costs. If there was anything that was going to be conflictive, I tried, steered myself another direction. And part of this initiation was learning not to fear conflict, not to fear somebody who would not be terribly supportive, somebody who might be negative. And without that overcoming that sense of fear, and it could be fear of, you know, fear of failure, fear of not wanting to take that step because there's just a little bit of doubt about, is this the right activity? And in my experience, I've never had a voice in my head say, do this or don't do this. It when we all have different ways that Spirit talks to us or guides us or directs us, and I've never had that that kind of guidance. And I spend a lot of time meditating and wondering what it was I was to do. The direction of my life didn't unfold at a very early stage, and I kept waiting for a voice, and there was never a voice. But as you keep taking steps, following your love, Joseph Campbell's great statement, follow your bliss. We've all been given things that we love to do, whether it's in the arts, whether it's in business or in finance or services. It doesn't matter. If we love it, there's a creative aspect to it. Business can be very creative. We've all seen how creative finance can be, and sometimes it's not creative in a positive way. So any area that you're in, even service, even dealing with people, can be extremely creative. The medical profession, extremely creative. You have someone who is a patient and very, kind of nasty and complaining and very hard to deal with. It becomes very creative on how you deal with someone and the principles that you would bring to bear in that kind of a situation. You can watch how someone changes their whole demeanor and attitude from being negative and nasty to being harmonious and loving without having to say anything. And that's the creative part, living spiritually. So the whole point is that if there is fear that is standing in the way of doing something, that's part of the human concept. And even if you take that step to break through the fear, and even if the activity isn't as fruitful as you thought or doesn't lead to anything more, just the fact that you've taken a step removes the barrier. And again, this is about freedom, this way of life. Breaking barriers, breaking limitations.
I find it very difficult when recently there's been the 10th anniversary of 9/11, for instance, and we've had it on the television over and over, how when you see or hear of any kind of really so-called difficult situation, I know that's in the past, but like say something in the present, a great tragedy or something, I know one should go into it to demonstrate, but it's so difficult. If you relate to those people, if you have love and you're relating to the people who suffered, I suppose, I mean, you know, if one wants to go to meditation, just think of love and enfolding in love. Is there anything you could say? Do you know what I mean?
It's
just that when you see something so drastic or anything like that, I find that quite difficult to more, I mean, you know, what would you say?
Okay. It's how you're approaching.
Yes.
It's your perspective of this.
Yes.
And this brings in a great principle, and it's a healing principle, because we have compassion. I mean, we don't like to see people suffer. But most of the time, those observations and those feelings come from personal sense. When we're dealing in oneness, there is no person out there. And when we see tragedy or we see catastrophe, natural disasters coming, the attitude that we take that can nullify that is withdrawing power from the realm of effect. Now that is one of the principles of metaphysics, to withdraw power. You can't withdraw power from the realm of effect if you are accepting that there are people out there suffering, people out there dying, people out there losing their homes or their livelihoods. So even though that is happening out there, we're not going to change that appearance. If we try and change the appearance from a bad appearance into a good appearance, we are immediately projecting ourselves out into that world, and there is a you, an I, and a disaster, an I and a disease, an I and an earthquake, an I and a hurricane. When you detach yourself from that, accepting that picture, so that you're not judging that appearance as from that human sense, you are judging righteous judgment, you bring into your consciousness the idea of oneness, of omnipotence. There's only one power, and that is the power of God. There's only one life, and that is God's life. What that kind of contemplation will do to yourself, it will remove that emotional connection to what you are seeing out there. And when that emotional connection is removed, you become dehypnotized. You are in a state of detachment. And then you really can look at that without horror, without fear, without the impulse to try and do something, and also without the human impulse for some kind of revenge or putting some kind of human reasoning to it. So it takes all of that emotional connection away, and then you have the ability to experience that presence. If you go into a meditation and wanting to have oneness with all of these horrible images in your mind, you won't be able to do it. Your mind, you're going to be in battle with yourself, because you have part of you that's saying, oh, this horrible thing has happened, and the other part of you that's saying, I must get into oneness. You have to be able to look at that dispassionately. And exactly what the Buddha did. You're practicing. Buddha gave the world the greatest healing principles, and that's what Joel has in his books. The art of spiritual healing really is based on Buddha's revelation that everything that appears to you in this world is an appearance. And those appearances are coming to you to be nullified. They're coming to you to be accepted or rejected. And if you accept them, you want to accept them from a spiritual standpoint, that this is a manifestation of God. If it's good, it's not the good that can turn into evil. It's not the good that can be taken away from you. There are many people that are afraid of having good, because then they worry that it's going to be taken away from them. And that's almost the greater fear than the fear of not having. The fear of having and thinking it's going to be taken away. So when you are free of that material concept, you then start seeing the good that is an activity of God. And that is universal. Everybody has that good. Everybody is entitled to that good, because the grace of God is our inheritance. So I practice. Sometimes it drives Sandra nuts, but I watch the news, and I basically am interested in what's going on. I like to be informed, but at the same time, I'm constantly withdrawing power where I'm seeing such ridiculous statements and stupid concepts about life and government and politics and economy, and realizing that omniscience is the nature of life. You can't separate omniscience from life. So you see a stupid politician, rather than, you know, getting all angry, you reinterpret that. Ah, omniscience. Even if it appears to be total ignorance, there's omniscience. Or you put it into any field that you know, that pushes your buttons. We all have areas that elicit some kind of an emotional response. My button has always been unfairness, people unjustly accused. I've had to do a lot of work on myself not to want to take up the sword for those downtrodden that are being used and manipulated and whacking the tyrants over the head. I've learned that I cannot get into that human mode of self-righteousness and have any kind of effective spiritual understanding. So I practice. I watch it. If I see myself getting mad, I bring in the principles until I can look at all of this, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if I turn the news on or read the newspaper in the morning or if I don't. Other than we're taught to participate in life, because if we don't participate, we're not bringing this consciousness into this world. We're not nullifying the air. We're not being the truth. You know, air can't stand up to the truth. If someone with the truth walks into the room, someone that's been spouting a lie just completely diminishes and withers without anything being said, because air cannot stand up to the truth. So if you are the agent of truth, you are the embodiment of truth, you have the awareness of truth, your presence nullifies any air without saying anything, without doing anything. The doing, the treatment, all of that is to detach ourselves so that we can be the epitome and the embodiment of truth.
At the same time as you're actually watching, okay, you watch it and can go away and meditate, that's easy, but to actually feel the truth as you're actually observing, that's the difficult thing, isn't it?
That's the practice. And somebody asked me once, when this was way back, and this person had been calling me for help and wanting to meditate, and just came to me to ask her, well, do you meditate when everything's fine? And she kind of went, oh. I said, if you only meditate when you're having a problem, that's like the painter saying, well, I only paint when I, you know, have inspiration, and then you get your brushes out and you go to canvas and it's not expressing what you want to express. You have to practice, and the best way to practice is when everything is fine and everything is going around great and you're happy and everything is unfolding and you look around you and you're aware of all these other things. Oh, I'm given the opportunity to bring truth to bear to whatever is coming into my awareness.
Following on from that question, what principles would apply to giving to charity?
Well, givingness is a spiritual activity. In one book, I can't remember where I read it, but giving is the grease that oils the wheels of grace. Without your giving, there isn't a flow established. And giving doesn't mean, you know, money. I mean, you give money to charity, that's fine. Supporting, but the true giving, the greatest gift you can give the world is the recognition of the Christ in all that you meet. And if you have that compassion and that recognition, then you're going to give to those people who are doing the practical steps of housing the homeless or you know, feeding the hungry, whatever area that you're drawn to support charity-wise. So I think that supporting charities is a very important part of living.
But the fact is that the so many charities you can support, and you tend to go for the one, as you say, presses your buttons, which means that you are giving power, reality, to those problems, because you think you're going to...
Well, I don't give in that way. There's, because we're living in the world, but not of it. Now, the charities that are solving the problems, whether it's, you know, Amnesty International or Doctors Without Borders, whatever, some of these that are, have very definite causes or seem to be more political than just helping the homeless or feeding the hungry. You can support that as an idea. What is the idea behind the charity? The idea of Amnesty International is liberty. Now, liberty is a spiritual idea. We don't have any... I mean, if we are living free, we could be like St. Paul, and the prison doors wouldn't keep us in, because we are free in consciousness. It doesn't matter what our physical situation is. So if we look behind the intent of the charity, then we're basically supporting an idea that is spiritual. We're not supporting the appearance, or we're not, I mean, maybe you can look at it that we're supporting one group fighting another group, but most of the time, the charities that I'm aware of, even if they are, quote, battling cancer or something like that, their intent is to educate, illuminate, and heal. And those are spiritual ideas. So, I mean, you choose where you want to give, you know, out of your, you know, carefully. I mean, you don't just give without understanding what the group are doing. And then I also look at how is the charity managed? How much money goes to the people they say they're helping, and how much goes to administration and all of that? And there's an awful lot of charities that I look at a charity and I see the CEO of the charity is getting paid $2 million a year. I think that's a pretty good gig if you can swing it.
Say, for instance, out of the activity in the meditation, we take a certain step practically, and it appears to the people of this world the mistake you've taken. What is the connotation of that, basically? Because any action taken out of meditation can't be a mistake.
Well, I think if you look deeper into the intent or the what it's going for, perhaps there's something that's not right in your experience there. All of our actions in this world are learning experiences, and sometimes mistakes are much greater learning experiences than if everything comes out the way we had anticipated it. So part of the activity of this is always being open and not having a set result in mind. If we have a concept of where this decision is going to take us, and we have a concept that we're going to end up out here someplace, then that's a concept, and that's in our, you know, that might not be the spiritual unfoldment. So every day that something is moving forward, I always try to be as open as possible. If it isn't right, I will discover it, or if we have to alter or change or move, it will be revealed. And if that's going on, then if it's revealed that this is not really an area that I should be going into, it stops me before I'm so committed to it that it's hard to get out. But usually the commitment to an activity comes with a certain degree of ego, personal sense involved. And part of the admitting, you might say, a mistake or getting out of a mistake is humility. And that we enter this work in humility. The I. There is only one I. The I that I am is the same I that is the ego. Joel says there is only one ego. So what is the ego that is normally referred to with CEOs or, you know, powerful people? That's a personal sense of I. And there's a scale. And as you impersonalize that sense of self, that I within you, and you move into the recognition that the I that I am is God, that takes a tremendous amount of humility, because you're realizing I of my own self can do nothing. It is the Christ that doeth the work. So your whole perception begins to shift, and you find that you function in the world through this I, but it is the one infinite universal I. And it's the omniscience, it's the omnipotence, it's the nowness of spiritual being. And when that's coming forth, the tendency is to personalize it. Oh, that was a great idea. Look at the, you know, and I brought that idea, and look at how successful it is. What is that doing to something that came through spiritually? But it's slowly shifting it back into personal sense. Personal sense is what killed Christianity. Accepting Jesus as our personal Savior, as the Orthodox said. I accept Jesus as the way shower, as the man who demonstrated that life is eternal, as the man who so was united in oneness with the Father that he was able to step out of this experience and prove that matter has no power whatsoever. But if I personalize that and put it just to Jesus, I have cut off that my experience, and I have cut off my further growth spiritually, because the Christ is universal. So the personalization of any spiritual idea takes it out of this universal realm and puts it in more and more into a small little group. And as that happens, it loses all of its potency. And if I see that happening, I see personal sense coming into an endeavor, then I start reminding myself what's going on. And if it's personal sense that has kept me going down a path that maybe I should have abandoned much earlier, then I have to take the consequences. And if there's others that are going to say, well, you made a mistake, you have to eat humble pie, then you do it. But you don't do it, again, from a personal sense. Error, once seen, is two-thirds destroyed. What does that mean? It means that the power that would have, the power to destroy, the power to discredit, is two-thirds destroyed, and the other third destroys itself. So if there's been a mistake, and the ego does not enter into the correction, then that correction happens without suffering, without denigration, and the mistake is corrected, and we move on, and we've learned from that experience. And all of us have a lot of great learning experiences in that area. The developing an awareness how personal sense functions is one of the greatest tools we have in our artistic toolbox, because it's like an early warning system when things are going well. As long as we keep giving the credit over to the Christ, the credit over to God, then we are blessed. We are carried along in this spiritual idea, and our talents are used by this, and maybe the world will say how great we are, but within ourselves we realize, no, this is a spiritual activity, and the adulation is meaningless. What is meaningful is how this is affecting people's lives. What, if it's an invention, if it's a how whatever kind of innovation it might be, if it's stimulating freedom, you know it's got a spiritual purpose. This is such a beautiful prayer that Lillian put on us, of Saint Teresa. Let nothing trouble you. I mean, this is really very mystical. Let nothing frighten you. The principles we've gone through this today. Everything is fleeting. Everything of this world is transitory. Everything of this world is going to be destroyed, you might say. If you take literally the end of days, what is the end of days? It is the destruction of material concepts so that spiritual reality can be revealed. So what is there to fear? We don't need to fear the change that takes place in this world because we know that there is this spiritual dimension to life that underlies all of life. God alone is unchanging. Patience will obtain everything. I might alter that a little bit. Patience, because I have all. There is nothing really to get. Patience reveals everything. Patience reveals that I am supply. I am the meat, the bread, and the water. It's all within you. It's all within me. It isn't out there. And it takes patience to let this transition take place within ourselves from the material perspective into the spiritual perspective. And the one who possesses God wants for nothing. The one who has his unity, who experiences God, who knows God, wants for nothing. Why? Because they know the secret that I and my Father are one. You can't separate me from the Father. You can't separate me from good. You can't separate me from life. It is one. And God alone suffices. Yes, it's all we need is God. Joel says that. All you need is God. Nothing else. So, Catholic mysticism from Middle Ages or early Renaissance?
15th century.
Is as relevant today as it was then. We have a different language, but it is the she had the same mystical experience, the same awareness. And what she was teaching is the same as being taught today. It's just in another context. And we can find this throughout history. And we can find it in every culture. Every culture has this mystical unfoldment. Look at Rumi in Islamic culture. One of the great mystics of the world. Let's have some more of this beautiful silence. It's like a feast. I feel like I'm at the dessert table. I've tasted some of the chocolate, some of the lemon, now I want some butterscotch. Thank you. It's been a beautiful day. I thank Lillian for preparing this place. When we were meditating this morning, I thought of Lillian. She is the Tyler at the temple gate.
This is the temple, this is for sure. Do you know how many years we've been here, John?
Oh, I know.
How many years have you come and been with us? This room is truly kept and dedicated as a temple.
I feel that. Everybody feels that. I think the moment they walk in.
It's such a privilege to have it and to have all of you dear ones come and share, because it's no good just being empty. It has to be full of the divine.
And we take this with us.
Absolutely.
So it is a privilege, and it's a joy to share this with you and to be in all of your presence.
And tell us about your new book, which is called...
Oh, it's called The Fullness of Joy.
There we are.
It will be released in February next year. Kind of, as the publisher said, this is what do they call it? It's a soft release, because I have a class in Hawaii in February and they're getting it ready for that.
Uh-huh.
But then it will go to reviewers and all of that, and we'll have its major release in the spring, in May. So, but it will, I'm sure...
It'll come with a blossom.
I'm sure it will be available here.
Through Watkins.
Probably. I mean, it's Divorce that's doing it, so they have a great...
It'll come through Watkins.
Distribution system,
yeah.
So...
You know, just as you were talking, I just felt Virginia here. Virginia gave... I don't know how many classes here, but she was here every year.
Yes. Well, there's such a wonderful tradition of this message in London, and in fact in all of England. So I know that as the groups change and, you know, our society changes, this is still growing, and it is an activity that will always be, and those that are aware of this truth and practice it stimulate this spiritual, you know, this new world, this new heaven and new earth. Look at, you know, that's, and it's all perception.
Yeah.
Perceiving the real. So I thank you for that recognition, and I recognize that in you. So we are one in moving into the world with this spiritual charge, so to speak, this spiritual purpose.
And we thank John and Sandra for coming all the way from Hawaii. You know, this is a long way. It absolutely brings the whole globe here to us.
From one island to another.
From one island. Slightly different.
Well, yes, but
the realm.
Hawaii has such a connection to England because of Captain Cook and our history. So
Absolutely. There's,
you know, I think there's hardly, I mean, other than the tropics, you all could be down there, and we all could be up here,
and
have the same, same beautiful.
You're only 12 hours difference, but that otherwise you're all one. So when I ring John, you know, this evening, and he's having his breakfast, I would have to count on my fingers.
I do too. Well, actually, we don't have summertime, so we're only 11 hours.
I know. Still, that's it. By the way, St. Teresa of Avila was about 1539, so it was 16th century. She was about 1539, around there.
Well, she had, I mean, that era had some beautiful mystics that were pushing the church out of its materialistic point of view.
Yeah. Absolutely narrow.
Yeah. No, we'll bless them all. And I'm sure that today, even within the organized churches, the mainstream religions, there are those who have caught this vision that are practicing mysticism within their own
Absolutely.
Organizations.
Absolutely.
But it's always this push against, you know, from the individual realization of the presence of God against the organization that says you have to do it like this. And I think if there is someone in the organization that can have the consciousness, they bring in the people because they want to experience that presence. And if there isn't a consciousness, the church is empty. So they're just words.
Well, just to sweeten even more, we've got goodies outside. Mm-hmm. So if Sandy and Suzanne, if you could give me a hand, we will.
Thank you.
Yes, John.
Thank you. So
beautiful.
So lovely.
Beautiful.